Welcome to the third lecture in a series of three lectures and a conference on November 12th and 13th on the thought of Friedrich von Hayek, in this the centennial year of his birth in 1899. I should say, at this November conference, there will be four papers presented over 2 days by Lord Ralph Harris of the Institute for Economic Affairs in London, Kurt Loiba of the Hoover Institute, Kenneth Minogue of the London School of Economics, and the Nobel laureate James Buchanan from George Mason University, to which you're all cordially invited to this conference, of course. These events are co-sponsored by the Committee on Social Thought in honor of our former colleague, and by the Liberty Fund of Indianapolis, whose founder and benefactor, Mr. Goodrich, was much influenced by his friendship with Hayek and his Saturday seminars when Hayek was here in Chicago. My name is Robert Pippin, and I'm the current chair of the Committee on Social Thought. My own field is philosophy, and that means that I'm in the unusual position of trying to organize a conference on one of the 20th century's most important economists, even though I'm very far away from my single college course on economics. I've also had help and good advice from Sherman Rosen and Gary Becker, but this has meant that I have also begun to learn a little bit about Hayek, and I am eager to learn a good deal more from our lecture series and conference. At the outset, some colleagues told me that since, in Gary Will's now famous phrase, the Cold War is over and the University of Chicago won, told me it would not be profitable returning to Hayek, that what he spent so much time demonstrating about the impossibility of centrally planned economies is now simply taken for granted, and that it would not even be like kicking a dead horse, it would be more like digging one up in order to kick him again. Those of us who have heard the previous two lectures know that this is not so. Sherman Rosen's argument about some aspects of the relevance of the Austrian school for neoclassical economics, and Richard Epstein's demonstration of both the power and limits of Hayek's theories for modern political thought and legal theory, made the case for relevance quite well. Learning about Hayek has turned out to be quite interesting. Like everyone who's lived through the political changes in America and Britain in the 80s, I started out knowing a little, of course, about his Nobel Prize in 1974 and about Hayek's great influence on neoliberal or libertarian political and economic thought, and so of the debate between proponents of free association and trade and proponents of Keynes, government intervention and regulation. Hayek was a member of the Committee on Social Thought from 1950 to 1962, and so wrote one of his most important contributions, The Constitution of Liberty, during his stay here, actually lectured on that book in this room. He was already world famous by this time after the impact of The Road to Serfdom in 1944, which circulated quite widely and underground in Eastern Europe during the Cold War, and the founding of the influential and prestigious Mont Pelerin Society in 1947, and he became even more well-known as the most important opponent of Keynes. But the nature of the sorts of evidence and arguments Hayek used to mount his case were quite original and ranged very far afield. Besides important work on the causes of business cycles, he developed that now famous claim about pricing and prices, that, quote, we must look at the price system as such a mechanism for communicating information if we want to understand its real function. The most significant fact about this system is the economy of knowledge with which it operates, or how little the individual participants need to know in order to take the right action. This claim about dispersed knowledge and similar original claims about spontaneous order were hardly the limit of his work. He held here in Chicago a philosophy of science seminar with Enrico Fermi and Milton Friedman, among others, in which he developed a neurological model of adaptive learning, all of which led to the book The Sensory Order in 1952. Well, as I said, someone like this has to pique the interest of anyone. And I'm especially glad that we can complete the lecture series with a perspective as interesting and learned as that of Michael Novak, the George Friedrich Jewett Chair in Religion, the occupier of the George Friedrich Jewett Chair in Religion and Public Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research in Washington. Mr. Novak writes on such a wide range of important issues, I hesitate even to begin to do justice to his many accomplishments. He graduated from Stonehill College and then from the Gregorian University in Rome, studied also at Catholic University and Harvard, where he received an MA. He's taught at several universities and published a number of important books, perhaps the best known of which and most influential is The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. I count at least 25 books and monographs on what has intriguingly been called the philosophy and theology of culture, and somewhat staggeringly, over 500 widely published articles and reviews, some of which many of you will know from his time as a syndicated columnist and columnist for the National Review. He is a former U.S. ambassador, a winner of the very prestigious Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, and several other prizes. It's a very great pleasure to have him with us today to discuss Friedrich Hayek, Practitioner of Social Justice.
Thanks very much for welcoming me. I'm really honored and delighted to be in this room, a hallowed room, I think, because of the presence of people like Hayek in it, but hallowed, too, because of the role of the Committee of Social Thought in the history of this country, when you think of the people who were welcomed here. And people like Hayek, too, who weren't so easily welcomed everywhere, and gave him a place of very fruitful work over a long period of time. It's a privilege to be in such walls. Now, it may seem odd to open the celebration of the achievement of Friedrich Hayek, mentioning an insight that he fell just short of making explicit, even though he made great contributions by expressing it in practice. I mean the concept of social justice. He's famous for his sustained and animated put-down of most of the usages of social justice to be found in public speech during the middle of the 20th century. He ripped the concept as it is usually deployed to tatters. Indeed, he stressed its fundamental contradiction. Most authors use the term, they assert, to designate a virtue, a moral virtue by their account, but then most of the descriptions they attach to it appertain to impersonal states of affairs. High unemployment, they say, for instance, or inequality of incomes, or lack of a living wage, is a social injustice. They expect the economic system to attain every utopian goal, as though all such goals are easily within reach and mutually compatible. They imagine that all social systems are under the command of identifiable persons, or should be, and they intend to find those persons and hold them responsible for outcomes of which they do not approve. Their main concern is to indict an entire system and its central institutions. For decades, they seemed to hold that socialism was a superior economic system toward which history was moving. Their diagnosis, methods, and remedies belong to specific intellectual traditions: socialist, social democratic, Catholic, Protestant. They seem not to analyze the failures of the systems they prefer. Hayek's critique lays out a multitude of objections to these prevailing lines of thought. But his main thrust goes to the heart of the matter. Social justice is either a virtue or it is not. If it is, it can properly be ascribed only to the reflective and deliberate acts of individual persons. That's what a virtue is. It's a habit of an individual. But most of those who use the term social justice do not ascribe it to individuals, but to states of affairs, as when they assert that this or that state of affairs, unemployment, low wages, deplorable working conditions, is socially unjust. It is usually the impersonality of these that they decry, not the calm and discreet choices of individuals. It's the impersonality. They seldom attempt to change minds and hearts one by one. Instead, they tend to use political muscle to change the laws and to coerce massive compliance. In this respect, they are using the term social justice for a regulative principle of order, not a virtue. And by their own lights, this is an illegitimate use. They are not appealing to virtue, but to coercion. In addition, they are not overly scrupulous about the personal habits, the virtues that is, of those who deploy political muscle, or the graft and corruption inherent in all uses of political power. In brief, their focus is not virtue, it is power. Social justice is a term used to incite political action for the sake of gaining political power. Hayek summarizes this thrust. What I hope I have made clear is that the phrase social justice is not, as most people probably feel, an innocent expression of goodwill toward the less fortunate, but has become a dishonest insinuation that one ought to agree to demand of some special, that one ought to agree to a demand of some special interest, which, but for which one can give no real reason. If political discussion is to become honest, it is necessary that people should recognize that the term is intellectually disreputable, the mark of demagogy or cheap journalism, which responsible thinkers ought to be ashamed to use, because once the vacuity is recognized, its use is dishonest. Social justice. How many sufferings have been heaped on the world's poor under that banner? how malevolently it rolled off the presses of Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler. Everything they did in its name. It is no wonder Hayek loathed it so. Hayek alludes to a second effect of 20th century's theories of social justice. Whole books and treatises have been written about social justice without ever offering a definition thereof. The term is allowed to float in air as if everyone will recognize an instance when he sees it. This vagueness seems both studied and indispensable. For the minute one begins to define social justice as a virtue, for instance, related to the classical Aristotelian virtue of justice, one runs into embarrassing intellectual difficulties. For most of those who use the term do not intend to raise the worldwide quotient of virtue. They employ social justice as a term of art, whose operational meaning is, we need a law against that. They employ it, that is, as an instrument of ideological intimidation for the purpose of gaining the power of legal coercion. I've never yet encountered a writer on social justice, religious or philosophical, who directly confronts these criticisms of Hayek, and I give a long list of them in the notes. I know of only one theoretical statement, as we shall see, that comes through the gales of his withering analysis intact. Hayek began by noting an anthropomorphic tendency in human thought, an itch to understand all processes, however different in kind, in terms of human agency. Consider the human animation and psychology given to animals, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny, the three little pigs and the big bad wolf. Humans tend to understand the world, too, in the light of individual psychology and individual ethics. They also project onto the politics and economics of modern complex societies the same expectations their ancestors held regarding simple tribes. They personify all outcomes as if some all-powerful individual, some chief, chose them or could have altered them at will. Initially, the term social justice was invented to make sense of the complex networks of causation in modern societies. The term social justice was in fact first used in 1840 by a Sicilian priest, Luigi Taparelli d'Azeglio, and given prominence by Antonio Rasmini Serbati in La Costituzione secondo la Giustizia Sociale in 1848. John Stuart Mill gave this anthropomorphic approach to social questions almost canonical status with modern thinkers in 1861 in Utilitarianism. Society, quoting, society should treat all equally well who have deserved equally well of it. That is, who have deserved equally well absolutely. This is the highest abstract standard of social and distributive justice towards which all institutions, still quoting, towards which all institutions and the efforts of all virtuous citizens should be made in the utmost degree to converge. This is an abstract standard toward which all efforts of all institutions and all persons should be made in the utmost degree to converge. Both David Hume and Immanuel Kant had been much shrewder on the relation between desert, people who deserved to be equally treated, and on social reward than Mill. Both saw that neither merit nor the welfare distributed by others can be defined by general rules. Hayek set quotations from Kant and Hume at the head of his chapter on social justice. Hume's is particularly sharp. So great, quoting, so great is the uncertainty of merit, both from its natural obscurity and from the self-conceit of each individual, that no determinate rule of conduct could ever follow from it. In other words, what Mill construes as a heavy moral obligation should be made in the utmost degree to converge, Hume construes as irrational pretension. Mill makes merit and desert sound clear and easy. Hume sees them as highly individual, obscure, and subject to self-centered bias. We all think that we deserve much better than we get. Mill makes reason seem luminous, dispassionate, objective. Hume sees reason as distorted and darkened by passion, ignorance, and bias. If there were time, I would like to show as well how the American thinker Reinhold Niebuhr, playing on this same difference between the behavior of individuals and the behavior of societies, in his book Moral Man and Immoral Society, calling attention to the two ethics, which Mill had collapsed into one. Hayek argued that justice is the indispensable foundation and limitation of all law. He was very attached to the idea of justice, and he hated the misuse of that idea. But he argued in the same vein that the reigning conception of social justice, in part codified by Mill, is an abuse of the term justice and is rooted in a naive anthropomorphic tendency, as we've seen. The abuse consists in taking the term justice out of the realm in which it properly applies to the acts and habits of individuals and using it illicitly to name an attribute which the actions of society and the treatment of individuals and groups by society ought to possess, as when Mill speaks of the highest abstract standards of social justice towards which the efforts of all institutions and the efforts of all virtuous citizens should be made in the utmost degree to converge. Mill here imagines that societies could be virtuous in the way individuals can be. Perhaps in highly personalized societies of the ancient type, under kings, tyrants, or tribal chiefs, such a usage might make sense. In such societies, one man makes all the crucial social decisions. We'll build the camp here. We'll fight in this way. We'll draw water there. Curiously, however, the term social justice did not arise in these earlier, simpler societies, in which it might have seemed appropriate, but only in modern times, when more complex societies are run by impersonal rules meant to apply with equal force to all under the rule of law. How then shall we judge these impersonal mechanisms and market forces that leave some individuals and groups in situations that evoke pity and a sense of moral outrage? As Hayek himself comments, and I quote from Hayek, "Yet we do cry out against injustice when a succession of calamities befalls one family while another steadily prospers, when a meritorious effort is frustrated by some unforeseeable accident, and particularly if of many people whose efforts seem equally great, some succeed brilliantly while others fail. It is certainly tragic to see the failure of the most meritorious efforts of parents to bring up their children, of young men to build a career, or of an explorer or scientist pursuing a brilliant idea and then failing. And we will protest against such a fate, although we do not know anyone who is to blame for it or any way in which such disappointments can be prevented. And we complain about natural calamities, storms, a tornado that hits here and not there, a cancer that hits a young 13-year-old and not another one. And the parents question, what could we have done? Why? Do not storms, plagues, wars, and natural calamities of all sorts sometimes punish the just and unjust equally, often unfairly, and even unaccountably? From biblical times, such arguments have been advanced against God himself by Job, the psalmist, and others who saw the just suffer and the unjust prosper. Does God himself lack respect for social justice? There is a great need in the human breast, Hayek notes, to hold someone accountable, even when in another part of ourselves we recognize that such a protest is absurd. I heard a great line on this in Israel not so long ago. A philosopher once mentioned to me that God promised Israel a land of milk and honey, said not a word about oil. And it's the only part of the region, apparently, that lacks it. Is that unjust? The birth of the concept of social justice 150 years ago coincides with two other shifts in human consciousness. The death of God, quote, the death of God, and the rise of the ideal of the command economy. Man, Aristotle wrote, is political by nature. Politics is part of nature, and nature's God undergirds its justice. Where God's justice prevailed with all its inscrutable ways, social justice was an otios concept. when God died, men began to trust in reason and its ability to do what God had not deigned to do, construct a just social order, what Thomas Sowell in his new book calls cosmic justice took over, a vision of cosmic justice that if God had made the world better, if we could equalize everything. This divinization of reason met its mate in the ideal of the command economy. The death of God, the divinization of reason, and the command economy. Reason, that is science, would command, and the economy would follow. The death of God, the rise of science, and the command economy yielded scientific socialism, where reason would rule, the intellectuals would rule. And it's not an accident how little criticism there was of socialism among intellectuals for so long. There must be 10,000 books on the coming transition from socialism, from capitalism to socialism. And apart from one or two, most of the pages by Hayek, there was very little on the one transition that really was necessary to know about, the transition from socialism to capitalism. It's astonishing, the record of intellectuals in the 20th century. From this line of reasoning, it follows that social justice is given an adequate meaning only in a directed or command economy, such as an army, in which the individuals are ordered what to do, so that under social justice, it will always be possible to identify those in charge and hold them responsible. For the notion presupposes, that is the notion the way it's usually used, which is what Hayek is dealing with, the notion presupposes that someone is accountable and that people are guided by specific external directions, and not by internalized personal rules of just conduct. The notion further implies that no individual should be held responsible for his relative position. To assert that he is responsible would be blaming the victim and denying the relevance of considerations of social justice. For it is precisely the function of social justice to blame somebody else, to blame the system, to blame those who mythically control it. It is no wonder that some who think in terms of social justice never seem to imagine a non-controlled society based on universal rules, internalized by individuals, and flowering in self-government. That idea has not entered the heads of many people that I have met, particularly in Europe. The idea that a society could be built that way without somebody guiding it, directing it, has never crossed their minds. It's not that they object to it, it's just not crossed their minds. And they do tend to think that people left to themselves would not obey rules, would necessarily act aggressively to injure others, and they've got to be restrained. Society, as they imagine it, is always under command. In fact, that's the way they've experienced it. It's always been under command. If it is not under their command, they see it as under the command of powerful others, who by definition are foes of the party of social justice, hence oppressors. As Leszek Kolakowski writes in his magisterial history of communism, after many years of faithful service to that party, the fundamental paradigm of communist ideology is guaranteed to have wide appeal. You suffer, your suffering is caused by powerful others. These oppressors must be destroyed. It's a very simple message. You can put it on a series of bumper stickers. And it's extremely potent. And it fits any situation in the world, which is what Kolakowski was trying to explain. How does a recondite ideology, which he himself and others spent years studying, become translated to peasants without any education in diverse languages and diverse cultures anywhere? You suffer. Your suffering is caused by others, those others must be destroyed. And there's not a word about what you do the day after the destruction, the day after the revolution. Who picks up the garbage? Who runs the water pipes? How do you organize whatever parliament or whatever else there will be? There's not a word about any of that. When the oppressors are destroyed, the paradise arrives. We are not wrong in perceiving, Hayek concedes, that the effects of the individual choices and open processes of a free society on the fates of individuals are not distributed according to some recognizable principle of justice. That's not a mistake. It's not wrong to see that the way an open society functions and the way a market system functions is not according to some recognizable principle of justice. The meritorious are sometimes tragically unlucky. The hardworking fail. Good ideas don't pan out. And sometimes those who back them, however noble their vision and their willingness to take risks, lose their shirts. Some evil persons prosper. Some of the just languish far below their goals. Some receive much greater rewards than others for much less, for equal or much less effort. The free society isn't beanbag. It may run on fairer rules and with more equal chances than any other regime known to the human race, but it does not and cannot guarantee outcomes. I remember a friend of mine, it may be an old story at the University of Chicago, forgive me, but a friend of mine when he was here wanted to campaign for Adlai Stevenson, went to the nearest precinct quarters and knocked tentatively on the door, and door being open, and there being no answer, let himself in. Fellow was talking on two phones, had a cigar in his mouth, and finally turns and said, "What do you want, kid?" And he said, I would like to volunteer to help out Adlai Stevenson's campaign. And the fellow said to him, "Who sent you, kid?" And he said, "Nobody sent me. Kid, we don't want nobody. Nobody sent." Further, no one individual, no Politburo or congressional committee or political party has any possibility of designing rules that would or could treat each person according to that person's merit, desert, or even need. You can't imagine doing rules that would fit everybody. I remember once I was named provost of a small college, experimental college, with the most right-wing student was the only one who was going to vote that year, and he was going to vote for Eugene McCarthy. The rest thought voting was a bourgeois illusion. But the night before I was took office, a friend of mine at a party said, "You'll never say an honest word again." And you know, he was partly right about that. For instance, one day a young woman came to ask me whether she could study for a quarter in our program in Mexico. I knew the young woman had had some problems with drugs, and there was no way she could go to Mexico. So on the spot, I invented a rule. I said, and I thought, now can I really make this stick? I thought, well, unless you've had at least two full quarters on campus, you can't go to our program in Mexico. And she thought, oh heck, I was disappointed, but okay. If I had told her what the ideology of the school was, we will treat each individual as an individual person, and said, no, in your case, you can't go. I want to treat you as an individual person with full respect for your individuality, I'd have been hanged. I had to work with the rule. So how these choices will work out for each individual, each of us, is not easy to put in a general rule. Hayek's vision of the free society is nobler and higher than the vision of those who speak of social justice. They imagine something like a beehive or a herd or a flock within which someone is both responsible for giving commands and for the outcomes. Hayek thought that a free society has no other model in nature, and not that model, but is wholly unique to the human species. Furthermore, this model has been put into practice in a full way only during the past two centuries. Only in recent generations has the economic order been sufficiently distinguished in its principles of operation from the political order, and both of them from the moral and cultural order. For institutions and practices to have arisen that allow individuals unprecedented scope in all three spheres for the actions and habits proper to free persons. Hayek held that free persons are self-governing, able to live by internalized rules, that is, by good habits. If you have inside each of us a policeman telling us the rules and assuring that we obey the rules that we ourselves have consented to. You don't need many policemen on the street. And if you don't have internal policemen, there aren't enough policemen that you can put on the street to avoid the breakdown of society. A free society depends on the capacity of self-governing individuals. If people, Madison put it, I'm paraphrasing, if people were not capable of governing themselves in their private lives, governing their own passions, how can they possibly be capable of self-government in their public lives? A free society demands a certain type of person. But Hayek thought that that's exactly what a free society is. Those types of persons can be self-governing with a very limited and very much checked and balanced government. And the same with a fairly independent economy and a fairly independent moral and cultural system, the religious liberty, liberty of conscience, liberty of the press. Congress shall make no law on those spheres, in other words. So three spheres. Hayek held that free persons are self-governing, able to live by internalized rules, that is, good habits. For this reason, they need only a fair and open system of rules in order to act more creatively, intelligently, and productively than in any other form of society. While the free society will never be able to guarantee the outcomes desired by those who speak of social justice, it does, Hayek observed, bring more rewards to all on all reward levels than any known system. It cannot and will not produce equal rewards for all, only higher rewards for all. Hayek summarizes this position as follows, and I quote from The Mirage of Social Justice. We are, of course, not wrong in perceiving that the effects of the processes of a free society on the fates of the different individuals are not distributed according to some recognizable principle of justice. Where we go wrong is including from this that they are unjust and that somebody is to blame for this. In a free society in which the position of the different individuals and groups is the result, is not the result of anybody's design, the differences in reward simply cannot be meaningfully described as just or unjust. When the term social justice first came to prominence, it was first used as an appeal to the ruling classes, as they still were, to attend to the needs of the neglected new masses of uprooted peasants who had become urban workers. To this, Hayek had no objection. What he did object to was, first, careless thinking, and second, the imposition on free and creative societies of an abstract conception of justice by coercion. Careless thinkers forget that justice in the nature of the case is social. The addition of social to justice has the pleonastic force of adding social to language. Hayek at one point gave a long list of 65 terms to which in modern times we tend to add the word social. And the cumulative force of the list is to make you realize most often the term social isn't really functioning. Such careless thinking becomes positively destructive, he thought, when the term social no longer describes the product of the virtuous actions of many individuals, but rather the utopian goal toward which all institutions and all individuals are to the utmost degree made to converge, if necessary, by coercion. In that case, the term social and social justice does not refer to something that emerges organically and spontaneously from the rule-abiding behavior of free individuals, but rather from an abstract ideal imposed from above. Behind Hayek's objections to the careless use of social justice lies his unique and powerful insight into the nature of the free society. Hayek recognized that the 19th century's addition of the free economy to the 18th century's new science of politics had liberated women and men as never before. For instance, in lifting the proletariat into the middle class, even Antonio Gramsci had confessed in the 1930s, capitalism was far more successful than Marx and Lenin had predicted. Soon, there would be no more proletariat in Italy, Gramsci said. I remember once on television in Italy in a debate with an Italian communist, he told me, Mr. Novak, you're not making an important argument on your side. He said, capitalism raises the proletariat into the middle class. And he said, we have nobody left to organize but students and professors. With great rapidity, in little more than 100 years, Europe's impoverished, uprooted peasants, Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, had been lifted into the middle class and given educations and were astonishing the world by their talent and creativity. Hayek believed that these successes of liberty, that the key to these successes of liberty was the rule of law and internalized law-abiding creative habits on the one hand, and on the other hand, an economic system founded on rules that maximize free decisions, discovery procedures, and feedback mechanisms. Open to contingency, chance, and serendipity, such a system was already providing unparalleled universal opportunities, but it could not and must not be expected to guarantee outcomes. For any attempt to impose outcomes would force a new and foreign architectural principle upon the system. Recoiling from the dishonesty and destructiveness of the common uses of social justice, Hayek writes, I have come to feel strongly that the greatest service I can still render to my fellow men would be that I could make the speakers and writers among them thoroughly ashamed ever again to employ the term social justice. Social justice would end up harming most those whom it putatively intended to help. Its chief beneficiaries would be the political and administrative classes. I doubt, for instance, if there's any continent on which the term social justice has been used more commonly than in Latin America for the last 120 years. And yet it's hard to see what good it's done for the poor there. Hayek's form of social justice, I seem to have dug myself a hole in saying, giving Hayek's sharp and vigorous acid critique of social justice. Given the strength of Hayek's argument against and feelings about social justice, it may seem grotesque even to hint, let alone to assert, that he himself was a practitioner of social justice, even if one adds, as one must, social justice rightly understood, as Tocqueville describes self-interest rightly understood. Still, in the sentence just quoted, Hayek does offer us a clue. The greatest service I can still render to my fellow men, he writes. This is not the only clue that Hayek saw his vocation as a thinker and writer as a service to his fellow men. He believed further that helping others to understand the intellectual keys to a good society, a free and creative society, is to render them a great benefaction. For the free society is an achievement of human wit and enterprise, daring and discovery, and its secrets do not lie upon the surface of things, but must be painstakingly searched out through much trial and error, often at the cost of blood. How terrible to ill-treat these precious insights then, or to lose sight of them once gained. That is what repulsed him about social justice. Used the way the term was being used, it was a betrayal of the free society to its enemies. Ironically, then, Hayek's war against the misuse of social justice was itself a war fought on behalf of his fellow human beings, a service he wanted to render them, an act of considerable consequence for, if I may put it this way, the entire city of man. Through his intellectual vocation, Hayek owed it to his fellow humans to defend the free society and to warn them of dangers against it, and he felt that obligation. His intellectual work was, in this sense, a work of justice. Justice is paying to others what we owe them. It was also a work aimed at the long-run institutional welfare of the human race. Doing this work well was not merely a matter of his own self-interest, narrowly considered, but of significance to the human city as a whole. It was a work of justice in a plainly social dimension. I make these brief introductory comments to introduce a conception of social justice that Hayek never considered. It is not a conception widely known. Yet having myself been troubled for many years by the failure, unwillingness even, of Catholic writers in particular to define what they mean by social justice, even in the act of devoting whole chapters or entire books to it, and I cite several of them, I came upon three works that helped me a great deal. One was by an obscure Marianist professor of social ethics at Dayton University in an obscure pamphlet, today almost impossible to obtain, who won me over by confessing the same discontent with the literature and then making a practical proposal. he pointed out that he didn't even refer to Hayek, but he pointed out that he could not find a definition of social justice anywhere, and that the way the term was used was incoherent. The second was an essay by Father Ernest Fortin, who trained here at the University of Chicago. The third was, of course, the challenge presented by Hayek. I didn't need much persuasion from Hayek about the misuses of the term social justice, or the dishonesty with which the term was employed by socialists, or the naivete of others. But he did help me to mark out with a bright yellow line the unacceptable uses of the term. Fortin gave me my first introduction to the history of the term, later reinforced by looking into Hayek's footnotes, which are really quite remarkable. Here's the way my thinking went. Ethical practices are not merely a matter of acting here and now. They are also a matter of habit, of learned capacity, inclination, skill, or to use an older term, potency. For a person needs to act well not only once, but again and again, and to be ready to act well, even when caught by surprise. Aristotle says that's where you tell what a man's character is, what he does when he's caught by surprise, because then habit takes over, then habit shows itself. So I was determined to rule out any uses of social justice that did not attach to the habits, that is, virtues. If they're good habits, they're virtues. If they're bad habits, they're vices, to the habits of individuals. Social justice is a virtue, an attribute of individuals, or it is a fraud, or so I thought. On inspection, I noted that the popes who introduced the term into the Catholic tradition, Leo XIII in 1891, Pius XI in 1931, always spoke of it as a virtue. It adhered in individuals. Next, I noted that Leo XIII had his one main intention in introducing the term, to ward off socialism, which for 9 or 10 explicit reasons he found to be both evil and futile. I think that's the most interesting and powerful part of Leo's argument in Rerum Novarum. He gave reasons why socialism is evil, but then he listed 8 or 9 reasons why it will be futile. It just won't work, and it can't work. And this is at the time when Mill is writing, under the influence of his wife, is writing about the possibilities of socialism. It might work. In other words, in thinking of the term social, Leo XIII most definitely did not think first of the state. He was opposed to the tide of statism, which he foresaw would end as badly for the poor as for the church. His alternative was to promote a rich social life, an active civil life, flowering forth in associations and organizations of all sorts. He noted that this was the authentic Catholic tradition, going back to the rich panoply of confraternities, societies, associations, and religious communities that characterized the series of renaissances that began in the 11th century. In fact, he cites the argument of Thomas Aquinas, who at the University of Paris was defending the right of Dominicans and Franciscans to teach at the university. The secular professors, including clergy, were trying to prevent the Franciscans and Dominicans from getting entry into the university. They were very good, for one thing. And they attacked their right to form associations of the sort they had. And so Thomas Aquinas was asked to write a defense. And it's the first systematic defense of the right of association that adheres in every single individual, the right to associate with whomever you please for good purposes. And surely it was right for the Dominicans and Franciscans to bind themselves together if they so chose and to live in association, just as the university itself was an association, an incorporated association at that. So it's the first defense of the right of association that Leo XIII cites. There were associations beginning in the 11th century for protecting and maintaining bridges and roads. You know, you had to protect every bridge in Europe to keep the brigands away, for beer making, for burials, for migrant laborers, and so forth. The great Tocqueville overlooked the medieval precedents for the American habit of association, but he was correct to attach so much importance to the modern need for associations. The first law of democracy is the principle of association, Tocqueville said. Finally, I knew from my own family history that great changes of consciousness inhere in the transmission of a culture from the old country to a modern democracy like America. My great-grandparents were serfs of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the mountainous country of Spiš in Slovakia. My great-grandfather was a game warden for a Hungarian count who possessed one of the largest castles in Europe, or rather the ruins thereof, and the lands around. For some generations, my family had been subjects of the emperor, whereas in America, they became citizens, which is to say, sovereigns. The transition from subject to citizen covers a vast distance, not only psychologically, but also morally. The moral obligations of a subject at that time, to oversimplify but not to falsify, were fairly simple and direct, can be summarized in three words: pray, pay, and obey. If you did such things, if you acquitted those duties, you were in essentials a good subject, a good man, even a good Christian. Pray, pay, obey. Becoming a citizen entails far larger claims on initiative, personal responsibility, imagination, and civic duty. It is much harder to be a good citizen than a good subject. One must exert oneself far more. Reflections on this transition, by the way, it's much the same moving from communism to democracy and capitalism. One must exert oneself far more. One needs a much larger range of virtues. It's no wonder that many people shirk it and don't like it. It's much more demanding than to live as a 12-year-old with somebody telling you where to work and what to do. Reflections on this transition helped me to grasp why social justice is a term that emerged only in the last century and not before. To be sure, under the term general justice, the basic concept is as old as Aristotle and was known to Aquinas. But the term had little utility down the ages until the end of the 19th century. The idea of democracy was shaking monarchies to their foundations, and the new economy of enterprise, investment, invention, and factory production was drawing millions from rural areas to cities in search of work. If citizens are not to rally around the unchecked state, as the communists and socialists promoted, then what? Leo XIII's answer was associations, labor unions, for instance, but also associations of entrepreneurs, associations where both labor and capital could meet, and a host of others, if not the state, civil society. Father Ferret, the Marianist priest that I mentioned at Dayton, had put much of this together, although when I had first read his pamphlet years ago, I was skeptical, but I didn't forget it. Having learned a bit more about family history and the history of associations, I was ready for it. Here's what I put together following Father Ferret's lead. Social justice, rightly understood, is a specific habit of justice that is social in two senses. First, the specific skills which it calls into exercise are those of inspiring, working with, and organizing others. That's what makes it social. It's the skill of working with others, of organizing others, of inspiring others to accomplish together a work of justice. It may be so simple as building a seesaw on the playground, or digging a well in a village, or, as I know in some villages in Poland, paving part of the road through the village. People banding themselves together to do that, just improving the life of the society, local, city, state, national, international. These are the elementary skills of civil society, the primary skills of citizens of free societies, through which they exercise self-government by doing for themselves, without turning to government, those things that need to be done. At the time of the American founding, such activities have been described as exercises in civic republicanism. Citizens who take part in such activities commonly expand their efforts as attempts to pay back for all that they have received from the free society. Alternatively, to meet the obligations of free citizens to think for themselves and to act for themselves. These characteristics establish the habit of such activity as the virtue of justice. The fact that this activity is jointly carried out with others gives one justification for designating this activity as a specific type of justice. General justice, Aristotle called it, social justice is called today, requiring a broader range of social skills than do acts of individual justice. The second characteristic of social justice, rightly understood, is that it aims at the good of the city, not the good of one agent only. Citizens may band together, as in pioneer days in Iowa, to put up a school together, or to raise roofs over one another's homes, or to put a bridge over a stream, or to build a church or an infirmary. They may get together in the modern city to hold a bake sale for some charitable purpose, to build or to repair a playground, to clean up the environment, or a million other purposes that the social imagination of individuals leads them to. This is the second way in which this principle of social justice is properly designated, this principle of justice is properly designated social justice. To recapitulate, social justice, rightly understood, is that specific habit of justice which entails two or more persons acting in association and for the good of the city. This habit is therefore social in two senses, the associative form of the activity and the object of the activity. One happy characteristic of defining the virtue of social justice in this way is that it is ideologically neutral. It is as open to people on the right as on the left or in the center. Its field of activity may be primarily literary, scientific, religious, political, economic, cultural, athletic, and so on, across the whole spectrum of human social activities. And to be sure, the way people who organize on the left do it would drive Hayek up a wall. But the way he does it drives them up a wall. And so you need activities on both. But both are activities of social justice as each group sees it. In the practical order, the time for argument is not infinite, and people would just disagree. And so you need to allow room for all these different initiatives to have a free society. Now to the ending. One of the great works of mercy is to give sight to the blind. For teachers and writers, this is a metaphor for what they try to do every day, to give understanding where there was darkness, that is, to precipitate those frequent light bulb insights that give expression to the acute pleasure, now I have it. No one who is reading through the corpus of Hayek's writings can doubt his tireless commitment to communicating the insights necessary to the health and preservation of the free and the good society. Few have worked so hard or tilled the soil so deeply or done so with so much originality and passionate instruction in economics, but also in politics, and finally in morals, in all three systems. Hayek committed his life to working for the free society, for the sake of all human beings in the future. He worked with as many others as possible to give this work diffusion. He worked for the good of the human city. He worked with others. That is, he fulfilled the two conditions that exemplify the habit of social justice. Yet Hayek did more than write and teach. I've seen his portrait in institutions on practically every continent, institutions that he inspired or personally helped to build. He joined with Anthony Fisher and others to launch a set of institutions committed to research and public debate on the foundations of the free society. Mr. Fisher chose a universal name for these institutes that embodied an appropriate metaphor that could be used in every culture, the Atlas Foundation. For it is ideas and moral commitments that hold up a free society, the image of Atlas. The free society is built on ideas. Perish those ideas, perish rapidly the free society. At considerable personal sacrifice, Hayek was unstinting in his willingness to help these and other institutions committed to liberty by traveling to them for public lectures, making tapes, serving on boards, providing international contacts, even offering shrewd, concrete advice. Hayek was an activist as well as a scholar. He was an intellectual engagé, as they said two generations ago, a public intellectual, as we say today. To work for the public good is a work of social justice. The most striking of Hayek's initiatives in this respect was his vision for and leadership of the Mont Pelerin Society, which he launched in 1947 as a prestigious international society of economists, political philosophers, legal scholars, statesmen, and others to probe and to discuss the contemporary crisis coming out of World War II, the crisis of the free society, so that after the horrors of that war, the world of intellect would not again rush pell-mell into ideas destructive of liberty. It was shocking the way intellectuals had supported the Nazis and the communists, and how few stood for the free society. One of Hayek's chief intentions was to draw religious thinkers into reflection on the desperate needs of the liberal society, and to pull secular liberals back from unthinking anti-religious prejudices. He believed that the friends of liberty are relatively few, and that those few must not work at cross purposes. He believed as well that the progressive bias in favor of the free polity, democracy, while cherishing disdain for the free economy, was a betrayal of the liberal intellectual tradition. And he meant to recover the term liberal in its classical modern meaning, meaning free economy as well as free polity. He had first proposed to call his new society, whose founding members were summoned by Hayek to a meeting in a village near Mont-Pelerin, Switzerland, the Acton Tocqueville Society, whereupon a distinguished economist, some say from the University of Chicago, is reported to have announced, "I'll be damned if I'll belong to a society named for two Catholics." A compromise was struck. The name of a nearby mountain was chosen. The society is still prosperous with far more members than ever before. I rest my case. Despite his deep contempt for those concepts of social justice that do injury to the free society, Hayek overlooked a concept of social justice rightly understood, that put a name to the specific habit of justice of which he was an eminent practitioner. Moreover, if Tocqueville is right, that the principle of association is the first law of democracy, then social justice understood in this way is the first virtue of democracy, for it is the habit of making the principle of association incarnate. This was for Hayek not just an empirical law, but should have moral consequences, quoting again. "It is one of the great weaknesses of our time," Hayek writes, "that we lack the patience and faith to build up voluntary organizations for purposes which we highly value, and immediately ask the government to bring about by coercion, or with means raised by coercion, anything that appears as desirable to large numbers. Yet nothing can have a more deadening effect on real participation by the citizens than if government, instead of merely providing the essential framework of spontaneous growth, becomes monolithic and takes charge of the provision of all needs, which can be provided for only by the common effort of many." Close quote. In brief, Hayek was something of a model for how a public intellectual ought to practice social justice, tirelessly, with wit, with civility, with gentleness, and with a very deep learning. As I've written elsewhere, Hayek did write deeply and systematically about ethics and society, about politics and markets, and above all, about the kinds of laws and institutions indispensable to human liberty. In the sense of working ardently to build a more humane society, he was a great practitioner of social justice. It might have killed him to say so, but he was in fact a model of the virtue of social justice, rightly understood. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have some time for discussion. If the floor is open to anyone who'd like to ask a question.
Yes.
Where do you see organized religion, especially Catholicism, in modern times as far as moving towards a less incoherent view of social justice? Do you see much hope in our trend?
Catholic social thought, could you hear the question, you think?
Yes.
Catholic social thought is barely 100 years old, that is, addressing the problems of modern societies, 150 years old, let's say. And if you begin it with Rerum Novarum in 1891, in its specific attempt to move in the direction of liberal institutions, critically understood, not just swallowing any idea of liberal, it came to an understanding first and slowly of democracy, much more slowly of the free economy. You can see the progress in that most clearly if you compare Rerum Novarum with Centesimus Annus of John Paul II, written exactly 100 years later to mark the 100th anniversary. It's the name of the encyclical, the 100th year. And there are passages in it which scholars have thought are quite redolent of Hayek. For instance, when he says that, when he describes the causes of wealth, and he says that, this is in section 32, for most of human history, the main cause of wealth was the land. When the Duke of Wellington won the Battle of Blenheim, he was rewarded by the Queen with 20,000 acres at now Blenheim Palace, in Oxfordshire. And from the land he was supported, and his family was supported from the produce and the orchards and so forth, and the wool and so forth. And then afterwards, by the Marxists, the cause of wealth was thought to be capital, meaning things, machinery. But in our time, the Pope says, the cause of wealth is knowledge, skill, know-how. He didn't use Professor Becker's phrase, human capital, explicitly, but that's what he's talking about. And there was a philosopher in Krakow who was thought to be the Hayek of Poland, with whom the Pope, on his visit there in 1978, spent what was supposed to be half an hour, went on for 3 or 4 hours. Anyway, I don't know exactly, but however it got there in Centesimus Annus, that theme, the cause of wealth is intellect. And he goes on to say it's enterprise and it's building community. And the analysis of the epistemic factor, the knowledge factor in the economy, it is very marked. In fact, if you compare that encyclical, 1991, with the Pope's early encyclical, Laborum Exercens, which I think is 1981, I think it's 10 years before, or about 10 years before, there's a remarkable transformation even in that 10-year period. In short, Catholic social thought, as John Paul II says, proceeds by learning from experience. It's not for the Gospels or those who are responsible for teaching the Gospels to work out the secrets of social and political life. But it is their job to look at what others are discovering and see what in it fits with the Gospels and what does not. And so it follows a little bit behind events and other analysts. But I think there's great hope, and the only way to make it happen is to do it. I mean, if thinkers don't do it, how are the popes and bishops going to learn it? They're going to go on repeating what they learned in school. It's got to be better in every generation. And it's just got to be done.
Yes. Michael, what you said was very interesting. That I'd like your opinion or interpretation of Hayek on, I believe, in the Constitution of Liberty and elsewhere. Well, Hayek was, of course, opposed to large government and opposed to many particular governmental activities. Favor of voluntary associations. He did not oppose all redistributions. He supported a number of redistributions. Now, he may not have called that social justice, but how did he justify that within his philosophical framework?
Well, because he thought not only as an economist, but as a philosopher of the free society. He saw that there are necessary political preconditions for a good economy to function. For instance, you see in Russia today the absence of the rule of law, the absence also of the habits necessary to make people internally do the right thing, even to know what the right thing is. That one of the greatest damages done by communism was for 70 years to pour muck on traditional theories of ethics, on Christianity, on Judaism, on humanistic ethics, and say that was all illusion and nonsense. And the only ethic is what helps the party. And so you've got generations growing up without an internal sense of ethics, except as their own experience as human beings teaches them. Well, Hayek saw that early on. You need that body of, may I say here, human capital, which is partly moral. And secondly, you need the allegiance of peoples. If you have a democratic framework, you need the allegiance of all the people to that system. And so they all have to feel included in some way. And that's the fundamental structure of his argument. You have to be careful not to do it in a way that makes them dependent. In fact, he hardly imagined how bad it could get. You had to put them in a position where they were able to use the talents. They had people differ in talents. Some really are not enterprising in the way others are. And it's not wrong. Same with Adam Smith. Adam Smith has a long list of interventions government might make in order to make the life of ordinary people better, let alone those needed in order to provide the rule of law. Those were very important to me in my early life because they provided clues that one need not be a severe libertarian in the sense of economics merely in one's thinking. One can think following such men on a much broader basis. Politics, economics, and morals.
Yes.
I like the idea that you mentioned, I guess from Hayek, that economic justice is to give people what we owe them. And it seems to me then that maybe this bad social justice tradition or impulse might come from a very different base, which has to do with, let's say, a family situation where a parent gives a child, a baby, let's say, what the parent owes the baby, which is a lot, and it's not an economic transaction in the sense of not being an equal exchange of value, but it certainly is a very vital exchange nonetheless. And so I could imagine that these bad social thinkers, or at least bad in Hayek's view, might be unduly influenced by that impulse, or that of a big brother giving to a little brother what he owes him, which isn't necessarily an equal exchange of goods. And that takes one then into a sort of a different realm than what you've been discussing. And so I just wondered if I've
well, Hayek's way of thinking kind of thwart your question a bit. He did agree about the importance of justice, and he did think of justice in a classical way as the habit or virtue or giving to each person and each situation and each opportunity. It's due. Just as you have to decide early in the morning of all the things on your desk, which ones most deserve rapid attention and serious attention, and which ones deserve less. You're always thinking, what is due to this or that, as well as to people. So that idea of justice is very important. However, he wanted to argue that a free economy does not aim at that directly. A free economy aims at producing such an abundance of goods and services as will raise the economic well-being of all, but not necessarily in a way that you would normally say is just. People don't always get what is their due. That was the point of those long quotations I took earlier in my lecture. People work very, it's not the youngster in class who works the hardest that always writes the best term paper. Sometimes it's the kid who waited until the night before and just dashed it off. But by golly, it is the better term paper. It hardly seems fair. So in a way, justice isn't always done. Hayek is saying, by some ordinary standard of justice, meaning hardworking, deserving, that standard. And and nonetheless, he wanted to argue that economy is more just, which produces the opportunity for people to develop more abundantly than any other society, and which produces goods and services, which raises the conditions of all at all levels of society, beyond any previous form of society. But it doesn't give individual justice in that framework. And his argument is a hard one for many people to swallow. But he says we must learn from the way nature works. Learn from the way talents are distributed. These things don't follow normal, ordinary rules of justice, as the complaints of Job and the psalmist and others make plain. However, and it's a big however, he did think that there are things we can do by organizing together to make life easier and better, more humane, more human for the whole society, raise the benefit, and do outside the economic system things which the economic system alone doesn't do. The economic system cannot provide for everything. You have to have the political system and a moral system have a lot of work to do.
The question from back over here.
So, notwithstanding his criticism of the idea of social justice, he did concede in the end that justice can be descriptive of the state of affairs as distinguished from the virtues of an individual.
Now, I don't think he would have used the term justice in that way.
I was borrowing from your statement.
Well, if I slipped, forgive me, but what I was trying to describe is a good society, which is a little bit different.
There may be something about the slip that is perhaps revealing of his position.
Well, I'd want to look at the transcript and see if I really did slip. I was trying to be careful.
I have a question on this score, that's a little more general than this, and that is,
one can take your point, or Hayek's point, about an excessive sort of mystification of social agency as if there's somebody back there to get and fix, and take the point about the importance of justice as an individual virtue. But I was also trying to understand in your description of Hayek where it would be appropriate to ascribe certain properties of institutions. I mean, institutions do for it, it seems quite conceivable that institutional life could protect a claim of entitlement that isn't justified. I mean, think of apartheid or systems of slavery or something, so that it wouldn't seem totally accurate to say that what's wrong with apartheid is simply that the individual agents in an apartheid society are behaving with ill will towards other members of the society. There are structural protections of entitlement backed by the coercive force of the monopolized use of force, that is the state, that seem to be a kind of injustice that isn't reducible to, I mean, it seemed like you wanted to describe this as an evil, but I was also puzzled why this shouldn't be an injustice. I mean, feudalism is socially unjust in a certain sense. It's based on certain claims about human capacities that are false.
Well, think to yourself, though, what is the response to such a situation? Think of it, let alone Hayek, think of it as Leo XIII did. Leo XIII did not want to go the route of saying that the injustices, which he also analyzed in existing capitalist societies, are to be met by a command economy, by a socialism or whatever else. And he argued that no, rather than proceeding in that route, what people ought to do is organize themselves together, call things by their name, and organize to bring about change therein. And that, I think, is a perfectly adequate way.
Yeah,
now, understanding that, if you want to speak of just or unjust structures in this second way for an institution rather than as a virtue, I would go along with that. Yeah. But you would have to see it's an analogous use of the term justice. Yes?
Let me come back to the question I had asked, because this is a Liberty Fund sponsored group, and I was at a Liberty Fund conference just before we met in France on family. And I made what seemed to me pretty obvious point that when we have a society where kids are born into families where they're neglected, they get no motivation, and so on, it may make some sense for the state to spend resources on these kids and Head Start programs and the like. Now, we can discuss whether these programs are effective or not. But it turned out that I was a lefty in this group. The other participants in this conference all attacked me. This wasn't, well, not many of them did. This wasn't a legitimate role of the state. Now we come back to the Hayekian justification that, you know, you transfer resources to so people don't rebel or they feel part of the society. Well, that may be the motivation in some cases, but I don't think it's the only motivation. And the example I gave, you know, there may be none of those problems. Nevertheless, you know, there's a legitimate question. Is there a legitimate role for the state in those cases? It's bad luck on these kids that they were born into these families, and if somebody says, well, there's good and bad luck, let's let it go. I don't think that's a sufficient story.
No, I don't agree with that either. And I left out of my talk, because it simply was too long, a section on the contemporary problems we're facing in welfare. And let me say in outline what I had written. It will be in the written version. I led a study group in 1986 examining both people from the left and from the right. Alice Riblin was on it, and Charles Murray was on it, and all kinds of people in between. And the idea was, could we get people both from left and right to agree on a description of what went right during the preceding 20 years, what went wrong, and what would we recommend? If we had a chance to begin again, to begin a war on poverty again, how would we do it? And the rule was, we would all agree to every sentence in this report. And if you didn't agree with it, suggest a modification, we would put in a clause or something to modify it. Or others say, like that. The bad news is I was asked to draft the report, which is a 30 Excedrin job, believe me. But anyway, we did get it through. And to our amazement, we got the support both of the Senate, which was Democratic at the time. Senator Moynihan was greatly behind it, and President Reagan on the other side, and Senator Dole. And it took time, but much of the current welfare reform grew out of that. And the distinction we made is this, is that nobody intended it in 1964. Those of us who supported the war on poverty did not intend that the family would be in worse shape 20 years later, especially younger families, than they were. We didn't expect the success of the program for the over 65 generation to be as massive as it turned out to be. In fact, so successful was the program for the elderly. If you remember, some of those of you who are older will remember that when John Kennedy ran for president in 1960, he was talking about poverty, and one of the great pictures in Life magazine and elsewhere was of the poor. It was Michael Harrington's book during the first Kennedy administration, not when he was running, but in the administration. What was the name of the book?
The Other America.
And so the great picture of poverty was the elderly face in West Virginia, or wherever it was in the country, always the elderly. They were by far the largest number of the poor. Today, that's practically gone. If you're over 65 and poor, it's because somehow you missed the benefits are there. They're there. And we now have a greater problem, namely the elderly. It's the over 85s are now more numerous than the 65s used to be. So it was a great success there. Younger families, much worse shape. Far more non-formed families and children born out of family and so forth. And the fastest growing number of the poor are children. What to do? It turns out if the state does the program, it tends to make it worse. It just encourages. But that doesn't mean there isn't anything you can do. And the effort has been to how do you contrive solutions that enable people in the very poorest neighborhoods to begin taking charge of their own lives and doing what people have done even when they were much more poor for generations, also in the very neighborhoods where the poor are now gathered. What have we done to break down those habits, and what can be done to restore institutions that help them to grow again, as they do grow naturally? And we ended up thinking there was not one silver bullet, but there are 70 or 80 different things you could do to change the ethos, not only in poor areas, but through the society as a whole, about the way we think about poverty and so forth. I'm not doing an adequate job, but it's in line with the analysis I was saying. How do you recreate the habits of social justice so that you recreate the strengths of civil society also in poor communities where they've broken down? And where rules that the welfare state have imposed have helped to break them down. For instance, that in a housing project, you can't throw out a drug dealer. You can't organize to do that. That's absurd. And you can't throw out ruffians and so on. It's absurd. But there needs to be a change in tort law and the rest to make it possible to do things like that.
We have time, I think, for one more very brief question and brief response. We'll miss our car. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know that Hayek had some conversations with Karl Popper, though I don't know the extent of their association. And one of Popper's main points was the anti-essentialist view, that is, that all discussions should be about concepts and not about words. Yet it seems that in a lot of, like in the mirage of social justice, although it seems that he's talking about the concept of social justice being misapplied, he talks a lot about, you know, if reporters would stop using this phrase, things would be a lot better. And it just seems sort of strange for somebody that had association with Popper to talk in that way.
Yeah, I'm not privy to the discussions with Popper, and so I can't answer directly to the Popper point of it. But I do want to point out that what troubled Hayek was the use of this flag as an organizing flag of many well-intentioned people to work, as he saw it, toward the command economy, or toward versions of the command economy, which reduced the circle of liberties and the circle of good habits, which undermined the good habits of liberty as well. So that's what troubled him in the flag that was being flown and the way it was being used. And he was begging people to be more, to be clearer about the concept that they're calling into being. His work functioned better, I've been arguing, as a critique of a bad use of the concept, even while he himself was working out in his own life an alternative to it. But he didn't quite put that into conceptual language.
Well, on that complex note, perhaps we should stop. Thank you for a very stimulating paper and a wonderful discussion.